Another edition of Shedding Light. We're here with Bill Guttentag, Professor Guttentag. He's a lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and teaches the course Leadership in the Entertainment Industry. He's probably the only member of the GSP faculty who is a two-time Oscar-winning documentary and feature film writer, director, and producer. His films include the recent documentary Soundtrack for a Revolution, which through music tells the story of the American Civil Rights Movement, the feature Nanking, and the satirical movie Live. He was the creator of the NBC television show Law and Order, Crime and Punishment, which filmed real trials and prosecutors from the San Diego County's District Attorney's Office. He has three additional Oscar nominations, a Peabody Award, three Emmy Awards, two additional Emmy nominations, two Writers Guild Award nominations, a Producers Guild Award nomination, and a Robert Kennedy Journalism Award. His latest work is a crime novel entitled Boulevard, which is based on a true story about a murder, a detective, a young runaway against a drop of the legendary Sunset Boulevard with its bright lights and the promises of fame, alluring the young, beautiful, and even the desperate who oftentimes fall into an underworld of crime and the sex industry. The book has just been released this month by Pegasus Books. And so welcome, Professor Guttentag, to the Shedding Light Show. It's nice to have you here.
Well, thanks a lot. Call me Bill, please.
Okay. Well, Bill, I just finished reading your book, which I liked a lot, and I just want to ask you, you peg much of the lives, you just really peg everybody's life. I mean, that's how it is.
Right. I think a lot
what
of...
What was your inspiration?
Well, a lot of stories that one encounters of real people, I think, are as powerful as fiction. You know, this is something that I've learned from making documentary films, that when you're featuring real people, you know, there's something that an audience will connect with real people. It's a sort of thing where, you know, an audience will watch a TV show or a movie, and I think somewhere deep into their heart of hearts, they may realize that it's an actor, you know, and that person's going to go home and they're going to, you know, whatever people do at home, you know, and then they're going to come back and act the next day. And I think, whereas a documentary, you realize that those people are real, and that carries a sort of special punch where you know that these things really happen to them. And so what I tried to do in this book was, in a way, create kind of a hybrid where it's certainly a work of fiction, but a lot of the things in the book are based on real people and real incidences. So the idea is, I hope that an audience will get pulled into the story and be moved by the story and care about the characters the same way you would in any kind of film.
And there's a footnote too that it says that it's based on a true story.
Well, I think the book is based on multiple true stories. I mean, I've been making films for a long time, and I think anyone who makes films sort of gathers up, you know, true stories. And I was doing research about kids in Hollywood, and you know, as I'm sure you know, that the kids all over the country, you know, run away. I mean, there's approximately 1.5 million runaways every year in the United States. In fact, 1 in 7 children will run away from home. I mean, most of them return fairly shortly, but there's a huge number of runaway kids. But all over the country, running from something. They may be running from abuse or a terrible situation home, and they run to places like, you know, Seattle or New York or San Francisco or you name it. They're running to that place. They're running from there. But L.A. has a sort of special thing where people are drawn to L.A., where you have kids that come to L.A., and it's not just they're trying to get away from a terrible situation, where they believe that they could become a movie star or a model or a rock star or a rap star, and there's this sort of magic of L.A., and they think it's like something out of Pretty Woman, where, you know, they're somehow... be on the street, but be sucked into this glam world, when in fact it really doesn't happen that way.
And also in your book, I mean, there's a flip side too about just people who are just are the top of their game. They're like moguls or friends of people in politics in Los Angeles. So, and how did you understand, like, this is what happened? I mean, it's almost like you have this dual role. You've seen people living on the streets, but because you have this access to the film industry, how did that play into your book too?
One of the nice things about making documentary films is that you find yourself in a situation where you meet generals and foot soldiers, you know. And so when you meet generals, you know, I've had the privilege of meeting many people really at the top of their fields, and where there's a lot of affluence, a lot of power, and a lot of money. But, you know, power you know, and affluence aren't synonymous with being good, and they're not synonymous with being great stories. I mean, I think, you know, there's this expression, which I think is true, which is, you know, the most interesting stories aren't found on page one of the newspaper, they're found on page seven. You know, so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you can still find interesting stories. And one of the, you know, my literary heroes was Studs Terkel, who died recently. And Studs Terkel had this idea that everyone has an interesting story. So if you're, you know, going into a fast food restaurant, the person serving you has an interesting story. The person outside, you know, begging change has an interesting story. The person, you know, who's dropping off the bakery goods has an interesting story. I mean, I think there's people have interesting stories. And part of what I do in making film is I try to listen and I try to hear the stories that people have. And one of the things that's sort of interesting, you know, not just for me, but for many people, is I think if you listen to the number of real conversations people have in the course of the day, they're pretty limited. I mean, you know, parents tend not to speak that much to children. Children don't speak that much to parents. Boyfriends don't speak that much to girlfriends. I mean, think about the number of real hours that, you know, a boyfriend and girlfriend speak together, or a married couple. You know, these are just not my, you know, sort of theorizing. These are, you know, statistically true, that people don't speak that much. So what I do when I make films is I'll get in a car with a police officer, and it'll be 11 o'clock at night, and we're going to spend most of the night together. And I say, you know, tell me your story. And people are often very happy to tell their story. You know, they may not have other opportunities. And I, in turn, use those stories often in film. And, you know, in this case, in a book, I use some of these stories in the book, which are based on real stories.
And the title of the book, Boulevard, the book is about, yeah, why Boulevard? Of course, the Sunset Boulevard. Tell right. us about why you chose particularly the Boulevard as opposed to, well, like Hollywood and Vine or...
Well, the Boulevard, you know, in Hollywood, the Boulevard refers to, is actually several boulevards in a way. There's Hollywood Boulevard, where a lot of the street kids walk back and forth. They sort of do this endless loop, and there's a lot going on there. And the kids, when they run away, they form these sort of ersatz families, and they bond together, and they live in squats. And that's part of, you know, the Hollywood Boulevard thing. But, you know, it's broken into multiple boulevards. You have Sunset Boulevard is generally for the women prostitutes. Santa Monica Boulevard is for the boys. And there's a section of Santa Monica that's generally for the young transvestites. So, you know, it's L.A. has this sort of, you know, tourist side, which a lot of people are familiar with, and they'll go to Universal Studios, and they'll stop off the El Capitan, and they'll go to the
Chinese
theater. And all these things. But, you know, when the sun goes down, it gets really late. There's a whole other side of Hollywood, which a lot of people are not aware of.
And, well, okay, we're going to just switch gears a little bit. But what, you know, you've had such a successful and highly notable career in film for many years. What inspired you to turn to fiction writing?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things about making a film, whether it's a nonfiction film or a fictional film, and I've done both, is that when you're making a film, it's only kind of what's on the page, you know, so it's you can see somebody doing something. Like I did a film in the DEA, and you see the DEA agents going off on a raid. Or in a fictional film, it's what people do and what they say. But, you know, when I started working on the novel, I realized that you can say, you know, she walked down the street thinking about this, and you can get into people's heads in a way that is different than doing it in a film. And I found the whole thing sort of liberating in a way and very enjoyable. I mean, it's, you still have the same thing in this book, like any book. You know, you have a plot and you try to care about people. And I think with any work of fiction or nonfiction, you have to ask yourself, well, what makes it interesting? Why does someone reading it, you know, at page 5 want to go to page 105 or 205 or 300? I mean, there still has to be a plot that drives a story. On the other hand, I think it's interesting to get inside of people's heads and find out what their motivations are. And I found that liberating and fascinating in working on this book.
Okay, and okay, well, what inspired you to tell this particular story about teenage runaways? Was this a social issue you knew about before starting your book, Boulevard?
Well, it's a great question, Kathy, and I think that that we, you know, there's this Hollywood expression which I think one of the old moguls said about it. Said if you want a message, go to Western Union. And so, if you're concerned about something, sometimes it's better to make a film about it that people will connect to. Like a big film now in the theaters is Hurt Locker, which I think gives people an insight into what's going on in, you know, in the war in Iraq. And I think you have a situation where if you look at something else, like Precious gives you an idea of view into sort of social problems. And I think if you want to reach people, people don't want to really be preached to. And I found the stories, you know, profoundly affecting. As I said, I went out on the street. I was researching. Initially, I was researching a film. And I started meeting, you know, many of the kids that this book is based on. They just started breaking my heart, you know. And, I one character was a 15-year-old girl who had just retired from being a prostitute and was kind of trying to stick to it. And I think you'd have to have a heart of stone not to be affected by these stories and these people. So on one hand, I tried to write a compelling book, which I think people will read. I hope they'll read, and I hope they find it, you know, an interesting book for all the reasons that people find books interesting. But I also feel like by reading it, you'll learn something and you'll have some insight into, you know, a social issue. And it's a big social issue. When 1 in 7 American kids is running away, that's a big social issue. On the other hand, you know, sometimes people, you know, want to hear read books about social issues with about as much interest as going getting a root canal, and so I hope that this is still an enjoyable read and it's a moving read and that you'll connect with the people in the book. On the other hand, you'll learn something.
And having worked you know, you've probably seen thousands of hours of footage of trials, criminal lawyers. You've been, as you mentioned, in the with policemen on the beat, particularly in Hollywood and West Los Angeles, probably along Sunset Boulevard. And how did you decide, okay, well, I'm going to just make this film and was going to take all this truth, and how did you filter it so that it's something that ties into the story? I mean, how did you do it all?
Well, there's sort of two parts of the story.
What's the recipe?
I mean, you know, I think part of the thing is this expression, I think it's generally attributed to Stalin, of all people, which said that, a hundred million deaths is a historical movement, one death is a tragedy. And so it's the idea that, you know, you want to reduce, you know, a large issue down to a very small issue. And this is something which, you know, I've tried to do in the past in other films, is that you need to have, you know, sort of a thin slice of an issue and characters that you can connect with. I did a film about the rape in Nanking, and one of the ways we hoped that people would connect to this story, and this is sort of, you know, I'm sure most of your viewers know, this is a situation where in the 1930s, the invading Japanese army in China, you know, killed hundreds of thousands of people and raped tens of thousands of women and girls. Well, that's, you know, this sort of very, you know, horrible statistic. But the way you try to tell the stories, you try to interview, you know, people who were there, people who felt it. And that's in a way of personalizing. And so it's not like, you know, there were tens of thousands of women being raped. Well, it was this woman who was raped. And it's not like there were hundreds of thousands of people being murdered. It was this man's mother that was murdered. And I think that's what you try to do. You try to look for stories that you can personalize it. And I think you touched on something else, which is important in making films, especially the kind that I make, is that, you know, you sit through a lot to get a little. I mean, the TV series I did, which was called Crime Punishment, we had what's called 390-to-1 shooting ratio. And what that means is for every minute that you see on screen, there's, you know, 389 minutes that you don't see it on screen. And I think that's true for any situation where you sift through a lot of stuff and you try to come up with the things that are the most moving. I mean, frankly, you know, in a book like this, this is filled where there's a lot of activity, a lot of action. But also I try to make it seem real, because there are plenty of times where there isn't a lot of action, but I think, you know, most people don't want to watch or look at or read the non-action part, so it's condensed. But the stories are all fundamentally based on, you know, true people and many, many true events.
Well, I think the plot was fascinating as well. And I was just wondering, okay, so not only are there teenage runaways featured in your book, but also there's this, you focus also on the police, the detectives, and how they're going to, and their relationship, and how they're affected as well by the other characters in the book. And how did you created these personalities from maybe watching, you know, hours and hours of fiction, hours and hours of, you know, DAs, police detectives, witnesses,
right,
court trials.
Right, you know, it's really true that I spent a lot of time with, you know, police officers and detectives. And one thing that is not written about very much is that, you know, police officers are exposed to an extraordinary amount of really horrible stuff that you would never want to see. I mean, it's just the worst stuff that you can imagine.
You mentioned quite a few examples. Were they real?
Yeah. The stories are, you know, as I said, they're not 100% real, but a lot of them are really true. Because what happens is that the police officers see stuff that no one else will see. I mean, even if you get to the site of a murder, you know, if the person isn't dead, there's a lot of really gruesome stuff there. And the police officer not only is dealing with the gruesome stuff and the sort of the blood still flowing and, you know, the...
Did you see that?
I've seen plenty of it. Yeah, too much of it.
And then you heard a lot of stories because you asked the police, detectives.
Anyone who's a journalist and spends time with the police, you know, travels around with them, you know, develops, you know, empathy for this idea that you're seeing this horrible stuff. And, you know, even if you're a physician in an emergency room, they also deal with some terrible things. But, you know, by the time they get to the emergency room, usually the victims are a little farther along. They've been treated a little bit. The police are first person on the scene. They're often dealing with the emotional issues, too. If there's a shooting, you know, there may be a child there who witnessed it, or a child that's lost a parent. I mean, it's really, really intense. And sometimes this stuff is profoundly moving and disturbing. And what happens is, like, you know, it's in the book a bit, but, you know, something that I saw where a policeman shows up on a scene and there's a little girl who's been raped and
I don't want to give away what's in the book because the book has amazing anecdotes. I don't know if I could flatten these personal stories to just one word, but it's pretty gruesome. So you did some of your experiences what you heard, probably saw.
Book. Exactly right. Because what happens if you imagine, you know, you're a police officer, you're on a scene, and you're showing up a scene where, you know, the worst thing you can imagine, a little girl's been raped, and, you know, the rapist is giving a confession right there, and then once it happens,
There's insult to injury.
Yeah. You know, the police officer just goes off to the next call. I mean, and so
and has to drop.
They've just seen, you know, the worst of society. And an hour later, sometimes even less, they're dealing with the next thing. And it's not like there's, you know, built-in psychiatry and all sorts of functions in there. And I think the way a lot of police officers deal with it is that, you know, there's obviously, you know, a lot of them go off drinking. But in some cases, there are these semi-secret police therapy groups. Mm-hmm. And these semi-secret police therapy groups, the police officers sit around and they talk about how what they see on the street affects them. Because part of, you know, their... taught not to show emotion
to confide with family members and just they get a psychiatrist
exactly.
And this is almost their support group,
right, the other cops become their support group. And if you think about it, I mean, police officers look at, you know, especially, you know, stuff involving children, they look at stuff that, you know, most of us would never want to deal with, and it's all part of their daily life.
And so, and the relationship, we're just going to talk about one of your characters, Jimmy, and his relationship, his personal relationship. It's dire. It's pretty tough. And it's interesting how you were able to create this drama with Jimmy, but also to give a sense of, I hate to just make it sound trite, but a sense of hope.
Right. I think. I think it's all. Look, you know, I'm someone who likes to read.
He was pretty down.
Well, I like to read books too, and, you know, and I don't think I want to read a book where on every page you want to slit your wrist. So, you know, I think that's this idea.
It's interesting, but you created amazing dramas to the point where, I mean, it sounds so trite again, but it's almost like a football game, you know, when there's 2 seconds, or it's almost like, it's like life, really, and you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know, and all of a sudden you just read a couple more lines, and you know, not my whole life has changed, but the whole direction of the book changes, and it's a lot of fun. It's like a roller coaster without in the dark and saying, was it going left, right, where am I going, up, down? And that was a lot of fun. And so is this the first time you've done fictional writing? Because you're a document, you have this wonderful career. How did you build this drama up?
I've done mostly documentaries. I did a feature film called Live with Ava Mendez and Andre Brower, and I think that, you know, life is full of dramatic turns. I mean, if you think about your own life, right, things change, and you just try to capture that kind of drama. I mean, the thing about these kids is they live really on the edge in Hollywood, and they, you know, they usually come from a terrible, terrible situation, and they form these kind of ersatz families, and they live in these squats, which are...
Did you go to one of them?
Yeah, I did. I went to the squats, and they're...
It's pretty graphic.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic, and it's described in the book, and the squats are, you know, most people probably listening to this probably would not want to live in a squat, but if you're asking yourself, what's the alternative? Is it sleeping under a freeway underpass?
That's what I liked about your book is, well, what could I do?
Right.
It's not like, oh, here it is. It's where else... could I go?
Yeah. I mean, it's what are your choices? I mean, if you're thrown out of your home or you leave your home, what are you going to do? I mean, some of the stories, as I said, were straight out of stories, which I heard from kids. I mean, I had a story in the book where a kid was, you know, this star athlete of his small town. And, you know, everyone thought he was the greatest kid in the town. And he came home one day and he's looked into his upper story of his house, and he saw his father like throwing all his stuff onto the lawn. His father was there screaming, you know, you're not my son, you're gay. He had found his diary, and, you know, and he just threw all his stuff onto the lawn. And that kid, when he went to school in the morning, he was sort of the beloved star of the town.
Big man on campus.
Yeah, yeah, he was the star of the basketball team and the football team. And then his father, you know, was screaming at him that, you know, he was gay. And the next thing he knew, he was, you know, on a bus heading for L.A. I mean, it sounds like cliche, but the bus really does go into L.A. and people get off the bus. And when they get off the bus in L.A., there are plenty of people there who are looking to exploit them.
I thought was the most amazing part of the film is just how it's just that dynamic, the mechanics.
Right.
And for some people, it's routine, and they'll just take advantage of the people who are in a situation.
Right. When you have a situation, I mean, Los Angeles, sort of every day the pond is restocked with kids coming from all over the country, and there's lots of people who know the pond is going to be restocked, so they're looking to take advantage of them. And some of the research which I did for the film, I spent some time in shelters and heard the people tell the stories, and they're really profoundly moving stories. But again, you know, throughout the book, you know, they're moving, they have ups, they have downs, you know, there's joy in the stories as well.
This is the Shedding Light Show. This is usually Bird hosts the show. Today, I'm Blue. We're here with Bill Guttentag. He is a lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and teaches the course Leadership in the Entertainment Industry. He has a prolific career, having won 2 Oscars, and his recent film includes a soundtrack for a revolution. And we're talking about his novel entitled Boulevard, which is from Pegasus Books. And Professor Guttentag, or I always call you Professor Bill Guttentag. So how can you, I mean, you wrote this book. It's gripping. It's dramatic. It's pretty gritty. And how are you able to just shut off and just say, okay, I'm going to go home, and then I'm going to be teaching in my course at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and then you just would work on the novel? How did you go back and forth between these two vocations?
Well, I think anyone who's a writer, and it's not the thing they do all the time, has to figure out ways of doing it. And I think I'm no different than anyone else. You know, I'm somebody who will just squeeze the time. I do it on airplanes. You know, I do it early in the morning. You just have to find the time to do it. I think it's hard to do sometimes during the day because, you know, it's if you're trying to multitask, it's difficult. At least it's difficult for me. And I think the other thing that I have in this book is you're dealing with sort of emotional stories. And I've done this in the past too. And sometimes it's hard to separate. I mean, I mentioned this film I did on Nanking, and you hear the most moving stories, and they're just profoundly touching. And I know that when we started doing the film, that the person who's doing the research would call me every day from China. She went there ahead of me, and she was just in tears from, you know, meeting the survivors of Nanking. And the idea is that, you know, I felt bad that she was in tears every day, but on the other hand, if she was in tears every day, it led me to believe that there was probably a powerful story there. And so then I sort of felt as a filmmaker, well, I have to try to capture this power in some way. And, you know, we went to Nanking and I spent a great deal of time in China filming this film. And the idea is you take these stories and you try to, you know, somehow take a story which someone is telling you and turn to something of value and meaning. And I think it's similar in a book that, you know, when you're basing on true stories, often those stories are there and they're just there for the capturing. You're just trying to tell them in a way that will move people. And then sometimes you're making things up. And in my case, you know, most of the stuff was based on something else, but you file it away and you hope it'll move someone at a later time.
And so you were doing research for a documentary right. on teens in like along Sunset Boulevard right. in Hollywood. Right. And then that was the genesis for the novel. How did that work out?
Well, it's funny that most of the stuff that I research, I'm fortunate, and then I tend to make the film on. In this particular case, I was researching this, and then I got a call from somebody else who wanted to make a film right away. And
just they, a film?
A different film. And they said, well, I said, well, I think it's a great story here. And they said, well, those kids will be back there. Just go make this film. So I got sidetracked, but I had heard all these stories. And I think the stories, they don't really change from year to year. I mean, there's different kids with different stories. But fundamentally, it's like every child's story is different, but there are certain patterns that remain the same, and I tried to capture them. And I believe that even though a lot of the stories here, you know, are based on real people and real incidents, you know, I promise you, if you walk the streets of LA now, you'll find many other stories that are similar. I mean, it's, you know, it's a lot of real struggle that goes on. I mean, a lot of kids who are on the street are dealing with, you know, they're dealing with issues of prostitution, they're dealing with issues of drugs. You know, it's really a tragedy. And some of the kids are very, very young. I mean, you see, you know, a lot of 17-year-olds, but you also see a lot of 14-year-olds, a lot of 13-year-olds. And I think that, you know, they're very powerful stories.
So you decided, okay, I'm going to write this novel, but right. did you ever think, I have so much on my plate? I'm teaching this course at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. I'm commissioned to do another film. And the only time I really have is it may be on airplanes or when I can get it. So it must have been a very inspirational cause for you to say, I am going to just write this.
Well, I feel like, you know, one of the great things about being at Stanford is you're surrounded by people who do lots of really great things and multiple things. I mean, I'm often in awe of my colleagues and how many things that they can do at the same time. It's a great university, and it's a great community. The community is filled with people who do lots of things. It's one of the joys about being on a college campus, especially a college campus like this. So I feel like I'm just another guy who's just trying to do what, you know, many other people around here are doing as well.
It's teaching, yeah, writing, doing research, yeah, joining a conference, doing conferences, and documentary films.
I think it all feeds on each other as well. I mean, this is something I've noticed with my colleagues that, you know, that different things, you know, sort of intersect, but they're also a part of their lives. And for me, I'm working on a book, but the books are based on, you know, true stories, and I sort of gather stories. And, you know, I mean, this happens to me all the time. People just tell stories, and you say, well, what makes for a memorable story? And hopefully you can try to roll that into a book.
Was teaching at Stanford, did that help inspire you to write the book, or was this some sort of was this idea of writing the novel Boulevard, was it in the back of your mind for a long time, even prior to coming to Stanford?
I started writing the book, you know, but I had a lot of friends who were, you know, teaching at Stanford and teaching writing. One person in particular, Keith Scribner, who was a class I took. I came here as a night fellow. And, you know, and he was someone I'm very close with.
Is it Professor Bettinger?
Yes. Jim Bettinger runs the night fellowship program. And I really owe it to them. And there's a lot of resources here at Stanford. And this is also a very literary community. I mean, there's a lot of really good bookstores in the Silicon Valley. And I think that, you know, it's a very welcoming situation for people who want to work on books and try to get their stories out there.
But again, the novel Boulevard, it is just really it can be pretty gritty, and it can be very sexy. Of course, it deals with the sex industry, and I think it's pretty specific to Los Angeles. I guess maybe it's certain aspects for that the square mileage of that area. It just compacts everybody, not everybody, but these characters into such a small area. Even though the story is universal about how, I mean, you know, there's prostitution and there's crime and there's corruption, but how did you? We've talked about this, but you had this dual life. It just right. You just would do research, but you'd have to fly back to Los Angeles to get that full experience. Did you use San Francisco? Did you use Berkeley, Oakland, Richmond?
The stories are really based in Los Angeles, and four of the stories, you know, I tried to put them in real settings. Like some of it takes place at the Chateau Marmont, which is a famous hotel in Los Angeles, and a lot of it takes place on the street, and they take place in law offices. And you know, in casinos and you know, and the real settings, well, mostly on the streets of LA. So I think you want people to feel a sense of authenticity. I think this is true for any writing, that I think, you know, readers can sense, you know, things that are not authentic. I mean, I sometimes feel this, I'm sure you feel this, that as you're, you know, you're reading a book, you want to feel like it's
immersed,
real.
You're getting drawn into it. Right, falling into the story.
No, I think that's true, and I think that's one of the reasons that we read things. It takes us to different places, and whether you're reading The Three Musketeers and you're going back to, you know, the time of the Musketeers in France, or you're reading, you know, The Road, which is taking you into the future and a pretty bleak future. I think you want to feel like you're being transported, and what, you know, you have to ask yourself, what enables you to become transported? What is it in writing that What are the tricks that makes you feel like you've been transported? I think some of those things are sort of details, and the details of the way people talk, and what do they say, and how do they act, and what do they wear. And I think that, you know, novels that I like, you know, I feel like, you know, I can, you know, it's almost tactile. Like I feel like, you know, the character can walk in, I would know them. You know, you can smell the situations that they're doing, whether you're talking about the smell of a disgusting squat or you're talking about, you know, the first pot of coffee being brewed in Starbucks in the morning, you know, and I think
that was a good scene, by the way, is in the book. Yeah. It's almost like you take a film and then you make it into, you put it onto the pages, which was a lot of fun. I think you even took lyrics from songs, and right. It's almost like maybe that was the advantage of, I guess I'm putting words in your mouth, but give you the advantage of coming from a film background and then writing it. You're just multi-sensor.
I think I sometimes think in a film sense, in that, you know, there's a thing, and if you watch movies where they say, you know, if you read the script, it says pull back to reveal. And so what pull back to reveal means is it's a shot where you're looking at something small, whether it's, you know, a ring on someone's finger, or a sore that's, you know, on someone's back that shows, you know, they're sick or whatever it is, that, and you're pulling back, so you're expanding the frame. And this is quite common in movies. I mean, you don't usually see the zoom so much anymore, but you do a lot of pullbacks to reveal. And I think when you're trying to write, in a way, that's what you're trying to create, is you're trying to create a sense of what is the larger picture and then what's the smaller picture. I mean, if you look at, you know, writing in a way like film editing, is the editing is the crucial thing. I mean, if you think about anything, if you show, you know, a photograph of, you know, a college student, right, and then the next shot that follows is, you know, shot of the girl is a shot of an ice cream cone, that means that's a different thing than if
absolutely.
You have a shot of a, you know, a guy holding a knife.
Absolutely. And so
this is something you do all the time. So, you know, is the girl, you know, about to be enjoying the ice cream cone or threatened by the guy with a knife? And so I think you try to do this in writing all the time, is that you're trying to say, okay, what is coming next? What's going to juxtapose it? And I think you also want to feel as if you care about the characters. And I think this is certainly not just true for me. It's true for every great book, that you care what happens. And as I write, you know, I keep asking myself, well, what is the compelling through line, the story? Why do people on page 15 care what happens on page 150?
That's what I noticed. There was a beat. There was this rhythm with the book. I noticed it was going. It was very moving, and it was very exciting. I thought it built up to a dramatic ending. I was shocked. I was thinking, oh boy, this is a lot more than I had imagined initially. I said, wow, this is pretty. This is really good. And I just want to get back to just a couple characters. We were talking about you getting to know how you know the policemen, the detectives, and then how they form relationships based on based on the difficulty of their job, the monumental difficulties they face every day. And between the two detectives, Jimmy and Aaron. Their chemistry worked really well, for this case, for the area, the part of Los Angeles along Sunset Boulevard. Do you have any plans for a sequel? Because I was curious, what else happened? What happened to page 299?
That's a great question. Something which I definitely consider. I think in a way is with a book or anything, you want people to feel like, you wish there was more. It's one of those funny things where you want to extend the form. I mean, without trying to sound too ridiculous, if you look at a ballet dancer, they rarely have their hand like up like a stop sign. Like a ballet dancer's hand sort of extends into space, and the idea is that you're trying to throw the line into space. And I think that's what you try to do with any book or any movie. I mean, one thing that I try to keep things moving. The last film I did called Soundtrack for a Revolution, which will be opening around the country in the coming months, the film is 83 minutes long. And I think that...
That's with John Legend, Joss Stone.
We're telling the story of the civil rights movement, but with new renditions of old songs. So we have, just this amazing music in the film. We have Joss Stone, and we have John Legend, and Wyclef Jean. And it's Soundtrack for Revolution Film .com, if I can do a promotion here.
Please.
And I think, the idea is that you really want to keep the subject moving. The idea of that film was that there may not be a huge desire for young people to see another, documentary about the civil rights movement. The story is outrageously powerful, extremely, extremely strong, and very, very, very moving and important. But by including these young artists in there and these, doing new interpretations of the old songs, it's a little bit of a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. I think people will come, maybe they're coming to see Wyclef Jean or The Roots, but they'll stay for the history. And the history is extremely powerful. And I think you want to keep, the beat going within the film. And I think it's important to do it. I mean, it's a big tent. I mean, there's some many, many important films about the civil rights movement, and they're just monumental achievements, and they're a lot longer, and they cover a lot more the issue probably a lot more thoroughly. But we're a 83 minute film, and in that 83 minutes, we hope to cover a lot of territory and keep it moving. And I think that's what I try to do in the book as well. Is I just try to keep the story moving, and I think it may just be a function of who we are now. I mean, there's probably a time when, books were not competing with video games and movies and you name it, where people just would read and that's it. And so books could go in a very slow fashion. But I think now if you're trying to compete in a world of, video games and movies and TV shows and everything else, that I think audiences have come to expect something that moves briskly. And I think that's just where we are. And I think it's a big tent. Look, there are plenty of books out there that I love that do not move particularly slowly and particularly quickly.
Your book is a lot of fun. It, like I said, there's a certain rhythm, there's a beat to it. And I guess that's kind of some context of Please Beat. But, I just also was curious, when you're writing a book, as opposed to making a film, you still have to shop it and you have to pitch it. Did you have were you apprehensive at all? You're saying I'm just going to make this because you make documentaries for yourself because you love the subject and you do the documentary for this book Boulevard. It must have been near and dear to your heart because you've made so many documentaries. All of them are just amazing, and you decided I'm going to make a book out of this one. I'm going to write this book on this subject.
Well, I think that with all things that you do like this, whether it's a book or a film, it's all an intersection of art and commerce. And you have to feel like you really have something that you want to say. And, I felt like this was something, I had to say. There's a famous line from Ingmar Bergman, the great director, who said, if you have nothing to say, don't say it. And, and I think the converse is also true. Where you have something to say, do say it. And I felt like this was an important thing for me to do. And I think in a way, with there's a great thing out there now where the getting word out, whether it's a book or a film, there's a great democratization happening. You know, when I was in film school, cameras were expensive, editing rooms were expensive. You know, everything having to do with film was quite expensive and really unaffordable. It was reduced to people who had a lot of money or professional or had the advantage of being in film school, which I certainly had the advantage of. But now you can, you know, edit on a you know, Final Cut, which is quite reasonably priced right here at Stanford Bookstore. You can shoot on cameras that you can buy at Fry's for, you know, very, you know, small amount of money. You can make your film. I mean, the only people who really suffer on this is if you're in a film festival selection committee because you see a lot of films. And I think it's a really good thing. And now people can self-publish books in a way that they never could do before. So I think there's a great democratization which is occurring now. And that democratization, I think, ultimately is really good. I mean, the tricky part is that when there's so much stuff out there, how do you cut through the noise? And how do you, you know, how does one thing stand out against another project? And I think this is something that anyone who's working in the arts has to wrestle with. What, why see my film as opposed to that film, or why read this book as opposed to another book?
And I just want to, by the way, for anybody tuning in right now, we're with Bill Guttentag. He is talking about his latest, his book, his first novel, debut novel, from Pegasus Books, and the book is called Boulevard. And it's based on a true story about a murder, a detective, and a young runaway against a backdrop of the legendary Sunset Boulevard. And if you were to cast this film, if this book were to be optioned for a film, how would you cast this?
Well, it's really a great question.
Give the audience,
Kathy,
like anybody, you know, an idea of what Jimmy would look like, who, you know, Tulip would look like. These are characters from the book. Aaron would look like. And there's some, you know, gorgeous, you know, men and women. Who would you cast?
Well, it's a great question. And some of the people
the film industry,
are iconic.
You made
and I really, you know, I'll tell you why I can't answer the question, because as I wrote, I was imagining the real people. And so
really?
It was all the time I kept thinking about, this is what the real person looked like. This is what the real person looked like. And it makes it hard because when you do films, it's very different. Because when
you
do films,
let us know, okay, who, you know, who Paul, St. Paul, yeah, who was St. Paul?
Well,
modeled just based,
there,
is a character in the book,
all
character.
The characters are based on, you know, kids who I met, you know, and some of them, a lot of them are sort of amalgams. There's a little bit of this personality, a little bit of that personality. So I was imagining them in my head. What's sort of interesting about a movie is when you write a movie, at some point, the character starts to own the part, and you start thinking of it in that way. Like, you know, when I wrote this film live, which is available on Netflix and lots of other places,
that's a pretty wild film.
It stars Eva Mendes and Andre Brower and David Krumholtz and Jeffrey Dean Morgan and a number of other really fine actors. And when you originally start out, you start thinking, oh, I could have this person or this person or this person. But
thinking about, oh, I'm going to cast Eva Mendes part.
Well, you know, you try to figure out what's a good fit. Eva was suggested to me, and I met with her, and we got along great, and she really did, I think, did a wonderful job in the film. And once Eva takes over the part, in a funny sort of way, if you're the writer-director, you write it, but then it becomes Eva. And then when you start doing subsequent
paths, you lock in midway of writing.
Yeah, so we had cast the film in that case, and then we had Eva, and the main roles were Eva, David Krumholtz on the show Numbers, and Andre Brower, who went to Stanford and's been in, got countless things. And at some point, they're your core group of people, and you're still working on refining the script and refining the dialogue. But then you start writing to them, and you start saying, okay, I want these words to come off, you know,
playing off their personality,
I want Eva to be able to say it. And honestly, you know, we had, you know, as I said, a wonderful relationship with all the actors. But like every now and then, Eva said, well, can you change this? I think it would be better if you did that. I would say feel more comfortable doing this. And of course you do that because they're taking it over. I mean, this is sort of what's interesting about, you know, so the film world in a way, that as what a director does and a writer does is you go up to a certain point in a funny sort of way. Like in the film I mentioned, Soundtrack for Revolution, you know, we would have these groups come in and record the old songs like John Legend or The Roots. And before they would record, we would show them clips you know, where the song would fit in, and we would talk to them and discuss it. But at some point, the artist comes to own the song. I mean, it's like as a director, you're kind of laying the table and you're, you know, and you're getting the cameras there and you can film it and you can edit it. But really, it's the artist's song. And I think that's true, you know, for acting as well, that, you know, when you write a part for an, you know, you're not sure who's going to be in it. But once you get that actor or actress, you know, that actress owns the part. And, you know, you have to feel good about it. I felt great about it. You know, and, you know, during that, this film, which is live, which I hope some of your viewers be interested enough to
Google it and look on Rent. It's on YouTube part. Yeah.
It's right. It's, you know, what's interesting is that, I, you know, when I would, if you were on the set, you would see, I'd be sitting there with, you know, using Ava as an example, because she's the star and I spent more time with her than anyone else on the film. And, you know, we would do a take. And then Ava and I would go back and look at the monitor afterwards and we'd say, you know, is it seem real enough? You know, and that was always the question we kept asking ourselves. Is it real? And what makes things feel real? You know, it's funny. Even films that I like don't feel particularly real. The hair and makeup don't feel real. And the dialogue doesn't seem real. And the lights are too bright and they don't seem real. And this is like a fake documentary. So then you go to yourself, ask yourself, well, if it feels real, then fine. We're finished. Let's go on and do the next scene. If it doesn't feel real, what will make it feel more real? And that, these are the sort of questions that we ask ourselves over and over again on the thing. And sometimes it was the way the camera moved, and sometimes it was tweaking the performance a little bit. Sometimes it was tweaking the words that the actor said a little bit. And I think in a way, I try to apply the same thing into writing. Like, what makes it feel real? Why do you read this chapter and say to yourself, does it feel real? Do the characters feel like they're three-dimensional? Do they say things that real people would say? And that's what I'm trying to capture. I'm trying to capture a sense of reality.
Was there a character in the book, I was very curious about this, who represents you, or like a part of you in Jimmy or in St. Paul or some of the character.
I think like in any book, you know, it's like all or none. You know, there's, you know, certainly not a, you know, sorry, you know, someone who fits my profile is in it, but you know, I think it's more like my emotions are in the story, and I think that as you write things, you have to ask yourself, what would this person do at this particular time? You know, it's funny. I was watching a movie, and the person I was watching with, it was like a talking chimp movie. I can't remember what it was. It was like, you know, a silly kids film. And that person I was watching with, she said, "Oh, you know, that gorilla would never say that." You know, and you know, in a way, what she was saying was, in a funny sort of way, the filmmakers had created this. You know, as a silly kids film, but the gorilla, you know, or the chimp was, you know, they had created a character, and whatever that next line was inconsistent with the character. So I think in a way that's what you try to do. Sometimes you get pulled out of things. I mean, it's funny. It's like, why are you in a theater? What makes you, you know, bite your nails at the same time, smile at the same time, laugh at the same time? Because there's a world that's been created, right? And if, you know, suddenly, you know, the person next to you, the cell phone goes off, that kind of breaks a spell. And I think what you try to do in a film, and I think in a book as well, is you try to create a spell. You try to create a sense of magic where you just want to know what happens to the characters, what happens to the people. And I think the way you achieve that is to try to come up with a sense of reality and a sense of veracity that feels like these are real people doing real things.
Okay, and I want to ask also, if I may.
Yes.
The last part of the book, okay, we have just 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, what gives you hope for? I mean, it seems like this subject, the subject of Boulevard, has a lot to do with teenage runaways, corruption, and amidst, you know, this background of Sunset Boulevard and people flocking, these beautiful people, and they sometimes land in just unfortunate situations. And what gives you hope? Sounds trite, but I would love to.
I don't think it's trite at all. I think that, you know, there's lots of really bleak situations out there. But one of the amazing things about many of the films I've worked on is that this idea that that really in times of extreme darkness, there's always light. I mean, the film that I did on Nanking, where there was this terrible situation in Nanjing, where, as I mentioned, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of deaths and tens of thousands of women and girls being raped. There was a small group of unarmed foreigners set up a safety zone. In the safety zone, they protected the citizens of Nanjing, and they saved hundreds of thousands of people. And they just did it out of, you know, sort of compassion and determination and, you know, courage. They didn't do it with guns. And in the civil rights movement, you have a story where, you know, you had, you know, peaceful protesters who changed the face of America. Look, I don't think anyone in my film, and I certainly am not claiming that, you know, the U.S. is a perfect country. I mean, far from it. But the country is a very different place than it was before the civil rights movement. And it was done by peaceful, you know, protesters who literally put their lives on the line in order to, you know, try to make the country a better place. And they did it peacefully, and they succeeded. And I think in this particular book, it's the same idea, that you have a situation where, you know, there's plenty of darkness and there's plenty of kids out there exploiting the kids, but there's also sort of ersatz families that are formed, and those families provide warmth, and that there's also, you know, cops that are out there that aren't just, you know, people, you know, with a badge and don't care about anything else, but they have feelings and they have compassion. And sometimes, you know, the soup is such that it's a really awful and dark place, but sometimes the soup creates a situation where, you know, there really is sustenance and there's warmth, and that people who are in the worst of times can triumph. And I'd like to think that my book is a book that does feature dark times, but also features a lot of hope as well.
I think that was that's a major message of your book, because that it's woven into the stories, as you mentioned. It's just not about teenage runaways and detectives just working, you know, nonstop and feeling down or in dire situations. But the sense of hope, that's what I just always carried away from every single chapter. I said, okay, well, it's just not all bleak. And I think that's the beauty about your book. And I hope you continue writing. And I only have a few more minutes. And I just want to talk about your next appearance in the Bay Area. You're going to be at Kepler's, and you'll be reading, I believe, excerpts of your book. Mm. And you'll be there on Wednesday, April 7th at 7:30 p.m. Again, at Kepler's Bookstore on El Camino Real in Menlo Park. And will you be traveling around? Will you be giving other readings in the area?
Yeah, I will be. And these are all going to be available in the area. I'll also be reading at the Stanford Bookstore.
Oh, when are you going to be at the Stanford
That'll
Bookstore?
That'll be in the beginning of March.
Oh, great.
And I'm gonna do
it's
Kepler's.
An evening, reading.
If
for anybody who's interested, they could just look, I believe, at Pegasus Books. Where can they find probably the Stanford?
Stanford Bookstore will have it. They've invited me to come. And so I'm really thrilled to be doing it at the Stanford Bookstore, and thrilled to be doing it at Kepler's as well. And
how about other places in the area too?
Well, I'm going to Los Angeles to do
really?
It.
Really? On
it.
Sunset Boulevard?
I'm doing it on Sunset. I'm doing
Where?
It, I'm doing it at Book Soup, which is a great bookstore on Sunset Boulevard. And so that should be an interesting
experience.
It's
better than Circus, which is mentioned in the book a couple times.
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of the places are real places that are in the book. So I'm really thrilled to be doing it. And I hope that that your listeners will check out the book. So thank you.
No, thank you so much. I think we have just a couple more minutes. Anything else we'd like to plug? Your website, you could check. You have a Wikipedia page. You have on the GSB.
The name of the name of the book is Boulevard, and it's out now, and it's available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, also it's placed on the web. It's also available in bookstores in the area, and Kepler, Stanford Bookstore, Books Inc. I've seen, I'm sure it's in many other places as well. And I have a film which is coming out called Soundtrack for Revolution. It's Soundtrack for Revolution Film.com.
It was at the Sundance Film Festival.
That film actually we premiered at Cannes. And
you're kidding.
Yeah, and so and
Mamma Mia.
So anyway, so that was
C'est génial.
yeah, so we're very fortunate about that and for that. And
it's going to be distributed by Landmark there,
it's going to be playing around, it's going to be
the
yeah,
guild?
It's, yeah, it's going yeah, to be Aquarius. Playing around. Should be, we're working on the distribution now, and it should be in
Please
San Francisco.
Please include us in the Aquarius Theater in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I'd love to do it.
And Berkeley or San Francisco, please.
Yeah, so anyway, and so I hope you'll search out the other work. I'm extremely grateful for you having me on, so thank you very, very much.
Oh, no, thank you, Professor Bill Gutentag. It was great to have you on. Again, the book is called Boulevard. It's from Pegasus Books. This is